From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Corte Madera.
Pleasant Hill.
Inner Richmond in San Francisco.
Montclair in Oakland.
Tiburon. Sausalito.
Japantown, San Francisco.
Berkeley, California.
Coming up, as Congress prepares for a showdown over the Affordable Care Act, we'll hear from Bay Area residents about how it's changed their lives.
Yes, we might have complaints, but it's an awful thought that it could go away without an alternative.
We'll dissect the arguments and discover some surprises.
I'm in this very interesting situation where I'm taking advantage of something that I don't particularly agree with.
Then we'll hear how most people are unprepared for the worst when a serious illness suddenly strikes.
There is no time to press pause and say, what matters to you? What do you want?
Stories that matter today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Doctors and nurses in San Francisco yesterday called on President-elect Donald Trump not to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. About 5 million people in California have insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and most could lose their insurance if it's repealed. Here are some of the sounds of the demonstration, which took place outside San Francisco General Hospital.
My name is Jacqueline Desjardins. I am a fourth-year medical student. Our demonstration today is a coalition of multiple demonstrations that are happening throughout the country. This is a national movement of healthcare providers and future healthcare providers who are concerned that a repeal of the ACA would mean our patients cannot seek health coverage.
My name's Ashley McMullen. I'm one of the second-year residents in internal medicine. And we don't want to see our patients lose access to critical primary care, preventive care medicine that they need.
I'm Michael Losak. I'm one of the second-year residents in the emergency medicine program. So it means for me, you know, not just being able to pay for healthcare because you have the money to, but being able to receive healthcare because you're sick.
Sounds of a demonstration at a San Francisco hospital recorded by KALW's Carrie Spivak. We're joined now in studio by KALW's health reporter, Marissa Ortega-Welch. Hi, Marissa.
Hi, Hannah.
So what kinds of changes should we expect to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, let's just start with remembering what the Affordable Care Act has done.
Mm-hmm.
It dealt with two really big things, private insurance and Medicaid, and we'll get to Medicaid in a second. But the Affordable Care Act said everyone in the U.S. has to be insured, and if you don't have insurance, you'll get fined. And so it set up what are called exchanges. It's basically a way for signing up for private health insurance. It's like a marketplace.
And so our exchange here is called Covered California.
Yep. And you can log on to the Covered California website. You can shop for insurance. It's kind of like shopping on Amazon, compare plans, and pick an insurance plan. And on that website, you also have to report your income.
Report your income, because under the ACA, the federal government gives a subsidy, a tax credit, right, depending on that income to actually pay for the insurance?
Yeah, exactly. The government is basically saying under the Affordable Care Act, you have to have insurance, mm-hmm. but we'll help you pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other things it did is it allowed young adults to stay on their parents' insurance until they were 26. And this is a big thing, insurance companies can no longer deny people coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Uh-huh. So how many Californians got insurance through the Affordable Care Act?
We had a ton of people enroll. California actually signed up more people for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act than any other state. So we cut the number of people who are uninsured in this state by half.
Hmm.
So I really wanted to talk to some of these people, find out what their experiences were using the ACA. These are people who have insurance through Covered California or Medicaid. And these are people who, whether they like it or not, their health insurance is on the chopping block.
So who did you talk to and what did you hear?
A lot of people are feeling really stressed out right now because they're afraid that they're going to lose their health insurance. But then I met this one guy, Danny Turner, who he actually felt stressed out when the Affordable Care Act was created. He's 29, he's from Livermore, and he identifies as a struggling entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
He is a Republican, and he actually just wrapped up a run for Congress earlier this year. And his story really surprised me. He was so stressed out over the Affordable Care Act that he says it actually caused him health issues that he eventually needed insurance to help cover his medical bills. Let's take a minute to hear his story.
So my story starts in 2010. I was a senior at Chico State, and I actually did some protests against the Affordable Care Act. It worried me a lot because I saw it as a step towards nationalizing about 13% of the economy, which I saw as a very dangerous thing for the United States. It caused a lot of stress in my life. Like, I was stressing over it far too much, and it was that stress that was sort of a trigger to the initial onset of symptoms of bipolar. And I had some pretty hefty medical bills that I would have had to pay had it not been for the provision that allowed me to stay on my parents' insurance until I was 26. It did help out a lot because there were like over $50,000 in like doctor's bills that we would have had to pay out of pocket if it wasn't for that 26 provision. From there, I had a few different insurance companies that were provided through employers. This took place until about a year ago when I'd been working with a startup that cut half its staff in about a 3-week period. So I lost my coverage through them. And at that time I said, okay, I'm going to look at Covered California. So I went through the exchange and purchased a Platinum PPO package. In this very interesting situation where I'm taking advantage of something that I don't particularly agree with. You know what, like, yeah, it's I can be called a hypocrite, but I just laugh it off. I find it more ironic than anything else. And I guess what I'd say is I'm principled, but my principles aren't going to cost me $2,000 a year at this point because I can't afford to have that.
That was Danny Turner from Livermore, and I'm talking with KALW's health reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch about the Affordable Care Act. So, Marissa, even though Danny was opposed to the Affordable Care Act on principle, he actually benefited from it.
Yeah, he was able to stay on his parents' health insurance until he was 26, and now he can get insurance through Covered California, even though he has a pre-existing condition of bipolar disorder.
And so these are the two popular parts of the ACA. A, not denying coverage because of a pre-existing condition, and then B, kids staying on their parents' insurance until they're 26, those two.
Yeah, exactly. And Republicans are saying that they want to keep these popular parts of the Affordable Care Act. They recognize that people really like them. What they want to get rid of is what's called the individual mandate, the requirement that everyone should have to have health insurance or pay a fee.
But can that happen? They want to keep the popular parts, get rid of the unpopular parts. Can they even do that?
Well, a lot of policymakers are saying that they can't, that those two things exist in a balance. You can't have one without the other. So basically, those things, it was a bargain that was struck with insurance companies. Insurance companies said, okay, fine, we will take people who have pre-existing conditions, but you have to get more people to sign up for health insurance. And that's what the individual mandate did. It required people to sign up for health insurance. So suddenly you have young, healthy people who maybe don't have a lot of medical bills, who maybe wouldn't have had insurance in their 20s or 30s, forced to now get insurance, and they are, in effect, subsidizing people who had pre-existing conditions, who maybe have higher medical bills.
So it all works together then, really.
It is. It's kind of seen as a balance, yeah. So I spoke to another person. She's a freelancer. She maybe wouldn't have had health insurance if it wasn't for Covered California, if it wasn't for the Affordable Care Act. This is Leila Mehta. She's in her 40s, and she's from Oakland. She's an independent contractor. She does nonprofit consulting work. Mm-hmm. And she says she's grateful to have insurance through Covered California. But she also has a lot of frustrations with it. She started having back issues right when she signed up for Covered California, but the options for treatment in her network have been really limited. Leila was born in India, and she goes there often to visit her family, so she knows firsthand that healthcare there is really just easier to get than here.
I went to India just to visit family and friends, and it turned out that after the plane ride, I couldn't walk. And so then I realized something was very serious. I went to an orthopedic surgeon, and he suggested I get 3 MRIs. It wasn't like, oh no, an MRI, I can't afford to do that. It was like, yeah, let's get this taken care of, and let's figure out what's been causing all this pain for the last 6 months. Luckily, I'm in India, so I can pay for it out of pocket. And within a day or two, I just saw the scan, and it was clear that I had a herniated disc.
Then Layla came back to Oakland. She had to wait 2 months in serious pain to get a steroid injection because there was only one doctor on Covered California that she could see. Mm-hmm. And because she's a freelancer, she has to call Covered California all the time to report income changes.
You know, I look back and I think about all of these frustrating moments where I had to, where I wasn't sure if I was going to be kicked off or what the situation was each year when the plan changed. But in retrospect, in a situation of recognizing that it might not be an option, yes, we might have complaints, but it's an awful thought that it could go away without an alternative. So I was a complainer, but I appreciate just having that as an option.
That's Layla Mehta from Oakland. We're talking with KALW's health reporter, Marissa Ortega-Welch, about possible changes to the Affordable Care Act. Marissa, so what about Medicaid? That's another area that's susceptible to possible cuts under the new administration.
Right. Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act also expanded Medicaid, which is the federal health insurance program for low-income people. Mm-hmm. Here in California, we call that Medi-Cal. So before the Affordable Care Act, you were only eligible for Medi-Cal if you were a parent, a child, a senior, or on disability.
Right.
And now, any adult who is income eligible can enroll in Medicaid.
So how many people did that bring on board?
Almost 4 million people were able to sign up for Medi-Cal under the Affordable Care Act. So now 1 in 3 Californians are on Medi-Cal. That's huge. According to the LA Times, I love this, if all the people in California who are on Medi-Cal formed their own state, it would be the 7th largest state in the country based on population, right after Pennsylvania.
Ha.
That's a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. People like Nicole, a 27-year-old born and raised in San Francisco. We're only going to use her first name to protect her identity because she has a history of drug use. Mm-hmm. She's on Medi-Cal, and as an adult without kids, she wouldn't have been eligible before the Affordable Care Act. She says without Medi-Cal, she wouldn't be sober today.
Probably starting around 22 or 23 is when I got into opiates really deep, started, you know, just as fun, and then, it just took over my life, basically. So at that time, at 23, I was on my mom's insurance, and Medicaid, or the Affordable Care Act, allowed me to stay on my mom's insurance until I was 26. And, you know, the funny thing is, like, when I lost that insurance, when I got off my mom's insurance, was around the time when I realized I needed help and I needed treatment. And that's when I was able to get on Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal pretty much saved me because it allowed me to go get help, and I found doctors and addiction specialists that were able to put me on a treatment plan, which is called Suboxone.
So Marissa, if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, will people like Nicole lose their insurance through Medi-Cal?
They could. And, you know, then there's all these other people who could just lose their primary care if the Affordable Care Act goes away. So they're not going to be able to get the preventative care that they need.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the possible repeal. Last Tuesday, the Senate voted to take the first step to repeal the Affordable Care Act. What are they doing right now exactly?
So they're not able to just repeal the act because they would need Democratic votes,
right?
Or the Democrats could filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using this process called a budget reconciliation process. It's basically a way to fast track changes in Congress, but it can only be used for things that directly affect the budget. So they're gonna use that to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It could happen as soon as this week. And what's interesting is that they may go ahead and repeal it now and figure out how to replace it later.
So they're going to have to figure out how to replace it. Is there a new law that people will draft up a new law, or what'll happen?
Yeah, so in the beginning of these talks, you heard a lot of people calling for repeal and replace, right? Like, don't repeal the Affordable Care Act without having an immediate replacement ready to go. But a lot of Republicans want to make good on Trump's promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act on day one. Mm. So they're really trying to fast track this. What they want to do now is what they're calling repeal and delay, which is vote to repeal it now, but have the actual repealing, the effects of repealing, be delayed until a replacement is in place. So that could take years. We don't know. A few Republican senators, including Rand Paul, are saying do not repeal without replacement, that that would be really dangerous.
Is it just a few? Is it enough?
It's just a few. It could actually still be enough, though. Even three senators could be enough to not pass the bill.
So are people going to lose their insurance, basically, is the bottom line. What should we expect in the next couple weeks?
Yeah, we really don't know. I wish I had a more definitive answer, but we are very much in a wait-and-see mode.
That's KALW's health reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch. If you'd like to share your story about the Affordable Care Act, or if you have questions that have to do with healthcare, email us at health@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. While Obamacare is one of the first items on the national agenda, one aspect of health care is rarely discussed publicly: planning for the end of life. But now Medicare is encouraging physicians to have end-of-life conversations with their patients before a crisis takes them by surprise. KALW's Joanne Marr has this report on advanced care planning.
It was the moment I was dreading. I got rousted out of bed at 6 a.m. My brother was calling to tell me that our 91-year-old father had fallen again. He was lying on the bathroom floor and couldn't get up. We called 911 and had him taken to emergency. A few days later, when he was about to be transferred to a rehab center, medical staffers descended on me all at once.
There are several parts to this form. You either want attempt at CPR. How aggressive would you want to be?
This doctor was asking me to make some quick decisions. Should he get CPR if his heart stops? Should he get electroshock treatment? Should he be put on a ventilator if he stops breathing? These were life and death decisions, and I had no idea how to answer these questions. I'd never talked to my father about any of this. I felt overwhelmed. What should I do? What would he want?
There is no time to press pause and say, what matters to you? What do you want?
Dr. V.J. Pariacoil is director of palliative care, education, and training at Stanford University's School of Medicine.
Their family members or proxy decision makers have never had this discussion with the patient because no one guided them to. And so as a result, they're sort of making these very high-stake decisions in the dark. So then the system default is to do everything possible, every treatment possible, even though the treatment might be ineffective. And the treatment may be something that the patient does not want.
For all I know, maybe my father wouldn't want every possible treatment. Maybe heroic measures like CPR and electroshock would be too hard on his frail body. What his physician and I should have done was sat down with him long ago and have an end-of-life conversation. It's called advanced care planning.
Dad, I want to ask you, what makes your life meaningful, and what kinds of decisions should I make on your behalf if you weren't able to speak for yourself?
Well, I think one of the things that you want to do is that I'm a realist, and if it comes to a point where I have some kind of a terminal condition, whether it's a...
What does terminal mean?
Dr. Jennifer Brokaw is an emergency care physician and patient advocate in San Francisco. In 2012, she conducted an advanced care planning session on stage at a TEDx talk with her father, former NBC anchor Tom Brokaw.
What does quality of life mean to you? What are the specific tasks that...
I want to be conscious, and given who I am, I want to be able to talk and communicate with the people that I care about.
Okay.
And that's important. And I think a lot about severe spinal cord injuries. If I'm confined in some way at a certain stage in my life, I don't want heroic efforts.
Advanced care planning gives patients the opportunity to share their concerns and goals with care providers and family members. Patients can set limits on the types of care and treatment they want. At the urging of his daughter, Tom Brokaw went through the process.
You know, when you get into your 70s, death starts to creep in on you, if not for yourself, you know, just other people that you know. And I know my dad's joked about reading the obituaries and just looking at, you know, how old they were when they died. And, you know, a lot of people are his age or younger now, and that doesn't go unnoticed by him.
2 years after their onstage conversation, the unexpected happened. Tom Brokaw was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a form of bone cancer that attacks the spine.
It was definitely shock. It was shock. It was disbelief. There was a little why me.
But after the initial shock wore off, Brokaw worked with his doctors on a treatment plan to manage the disease. He opted against a stem cell transplant operation because of his age and the risks involved. His daughter Jennifer says that advanced care planning gave him important guidance for the critical decisions he needed to make.
It prepared him in a way that he probably couldn't even articulate for when the doctor said, you know, Tom, you have a malignancy, you know, and it's not curable. Having gone through that thought process when he was well and had no scary thing on the horizon was probably a psychological buffer or, you know, a set of tools that he had created in his brain without even knowing it. And he was able to think about this cancer in a less scary and more organized way.
A recent study shows that having end-of-life conversations with patients can reduce their stress and anxieties. Tom Brokaw was fortunate to have a doctor in his family, his daughter, who advocated for him. Most of us aren't as lucky. The vast majority of Americans don't have conversations about end-of-life care with their doctors. To encourage advanced care planning, Medicare recently announced it will reimburse physicians for conducting end-of-life conversations. Palliative care specialist Brooke Calton is teaching this course on advanced care planning and improving communication skills.
And I want you to think about a serious illness conversation you've witnessed in the past and think about what communication skills or techniques worked really well, and then if there was anything that could have gone better.
In Dr. Calton's class at UC San Francisco's Medical School, students are learning how to carry on conversations by using role play.
I'm a student doctor. I'll be talking with you today. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Max Pochabit is a medical student in Dr. Calton's class. He's doing a role play with an actor playing the part of Sandra, a daughter whose mother is very ill. Sandra's mother has just been admitted to the hospital with a serious infection.
But, you know, I'm so worried about her. She just seems so sick. Yeah.
Is there, if time were shorter than we were hoping?
What do you mean, if time were shorter?
Carrying on end-of-life conversations can be difficult and awkward at first. It takes skill and patience to find the right language.
You feel tongue-tied going and telling a patient because you don't know whether they will start crying.
Again, Stanford Palliative Care Director Vijay Periacoil.
You don't know whether you can control your emotions, so it's incredibly important to role play this.
Ideally, family members should have end-of-life discussions with each other well in advance of a medical crisis.
What would it be like if, say, Dad were really sick, so sick that he actually couldn't tell us, he couldn't talk with us about what mattered to him, what kind of medical care he wanted.
Radio host Dawn Gross conducted this end-of-life conversation with her two teenage children, live on the air during her KALW call-in show, Dying to Talk.
He would want his family with him when he was dying.
When he was dying or
in the hospital.
Or in the hospital, very sick, that the first thing to do is to gather family.
In her role as palliative care specialist at UCSF, Dr. Gross has led many end-of-life conversations with patients of all ages. She wants to make sure her children know and understand their parents' final wishes, without all the guessing and uncertainty.
This is so not about how do you want to die, because we really have no control over that. It's how do you want to live until you die? And the only way to know that is to talk about it.
Okay, this is it. Today's the day you're going home.
Okay.
My father was more than ready to go home after nearly a month in rehab. My father now has dementia, and it's probably too late to have that end-of-life conversation with him. Complex questions are now beyond his comprehension. Like many family members who waited too late, I'll have to make my best guess at what his wishes would be when we cross that bridge. For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
The End of Life Radio Project is a series of programs made possible by funding from the Association of Healthcare Journalists. Our series continues next Tuesday with a report on palliative care, alleviating pain, and providing comfort care at the end of life.
Honestly, I think that they both knew that. I think we all knew that. You know, I think even the doctors in the ICU knew it. It just took somebody to say it's okay to acknowledge that. It's okay to say there's an alternative to this.
Conversations for the End of Life continue next Tuesday, right here on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's Cross Currents. Our team includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Strempel, and Beatrice Thomas. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.